In an exclusive you won't see anywhere else, tonight we're speaking with Sergeant Ken Harrelson. Sergeant Ken Harrelson was one of the J6 defendants on trial during the Oath Keepers trial, the one with Stuart Rhodes, of course. That's where the Department of Injustice knowingly put two witnesses on the stand that lied. Tonight, he's speaking out after just being released from prison, and he joins us exclusively. January 6th, defendant John Sullivan has just been sentenced to 6 years in prison for his role on January 6th. Now, many of you aren't very fond of John Sullivan because he's a known BLM supporter and allegedly an activist for Antifa. Well, tonight, Steve Baker joins us to debunk all of the rumors regarding John Sullivan. The FDIC has just seized control of another bank. Dr. Kirk Elliott joins us to discuss. All that and more on the Brianna Morello Show. Now, last week, we had some very exciting news. One of the January 6th defendants who we've covered on this show extensively was released from a halfway home. That individual is Sergeant Ken Harrelson, as you can see in this photo. It's his wife, and it's also the Born to Ride for 45 crew greeting him after being released. And in an exclusive, we've got Sergeant Ken Harrelson joining us today to discuss. First off, Sergeant Ken Harrelson, thank you so much for joining us and welcome home. We're so happy to see you back home with your wife, with your pups. It's really, really just a great thing to see.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate all the support you guys have shown throughout this whole ordeal. You know, and it means a lot. So,
yeah. Well, rightfully so, Ken, because what's happened to you has been absolutely egregious. And you deserve justice, specifically you, because we witnessed, and I've spoken about it on the show, and we'll go into detail in a little bit, but the DOJ committed perjury, had witnesses on the stand committing perjury during your trial, and you haven't been able to speak out about it because obviously you've been incarcerated since, and you've been incarcerated for over about 3 years now. And so it's heartbreaking to see this happen, and we're going to get into that in a minute. But just tell us, I mean, it's been, like I mentioned, over 3 years since you were arrested and dragged off into Washington, D.C. How do you feel after being released?
I feel good. You know, it was a warm welcome home. All my friends and family, even, you know, my former employer, everyone around town, you know, has been real, real nice. I still have touch and go moments. The stress and, you know, late night thinking about things, it hits me from time to time. But other than that, I mean, it feels good. Being able to get out and move around and just enjoy the Florida weather.
Yeah. I mean, that's the crazy part in all of this. Walk us through what it was like being in prison. We'll go with that specifically because, well, I don't think most Americans understand what actually takes place and the type of living conditions that you have to endure. Because, I mean, how often were you getting sunlight and allowed out of your cells?
I wasn't outside at all. So they picked me up in March 10th of 21. And I didn't arrive in D.C. until around June. But that whole time I was not outside. I think I was in Northern Neck for about a month and I got outside one time there. But it was just like a 100-foot by 100-foot squared in area with 20-foot walls, no real sun because it was Virginia and, you know, the weather was still kind of inclement there. So, but even in DC, they didn't let us go out. The whole COVID ordeal had the facility basically on lockdown. It was a rough time, especially being a guy from Florida, you know, enjoys being outdoors and, you know, but there was other coping mechanisms, but I mean, it was rough not to be able, and even after COVID was over, for some reason, they sought to not let us outside near as much. You know, it was like 2 years probably before I walked outside, you know, onto the rec yard in D.C., and then they only let us out like once every 2 months after that, if that, you know, just for an hour. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's unacceptable. I mean, I spoke to members of Congress who said that they came to visit and, you know, their staff said that when they first got there, they could smell bleach because they knew they were cleaning up prior to their arrival and that they had just put fresh paint over the walls. But from my understanding, it made them physically sick. And yeah. They told me that there was mold in the jail and that they were covering it up. And so yeah. We were all deeply concerned about what was happening with you and everyone else who was being held there, because it was very, very obvious the conditions were not livable and no human being should be forced to live in those conditions.
Well, it just wasn't for Congress either. It was anytime the marshals would come in to do their inspections, because they have contracts through the Marshal Service to house pretrial detainees. And they, you know, they would get notice that they were coming and they would come in and just do a hard clean and, you know, paint over the mold, try to hide, you know, the bad stuff. And, you know, they had a time with the J6 defendants, because we didn't, you know, there were some places we didn't paint over just so we could show like the actual conditions and stuff. You know, there's some of those guys in there were pretty good about figuring out ways that we could try to show the marshals what were going on. But I mean, in the end of the day, it's really just about money. So they didn't really, you know, it was just, they would say, okay, well, they'll get it covered up. We'll get it fixed. And, you know, then they'd lock us down for a month because we tried to show the realities of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is not acceptable. I mean, I'm from New York and I know Rikers Island has been sued and the city has been sued for the conditions in Rikers Island. So I do hope that all of you who were forced to live in these conditions, you guys get a legal team together to go after them. Honestly, I mean, I've heard the horror stories about the DC Gulag regarding the quality of food that they were forcing you guys to consume. It wasn't just moldy walls. A lot of you guys were sick because of the food alone. Is that what happened?
Yeah, there was no meat products. It was all soy. It was brought in from outside sources. They didn't, you know, they said it because of COVID, they had shut down their food services in the facility. So they were contracting a company to bring in food, but the food was atrocious. So, I mean, it was, you know, we would get like a breakfast tray with boiled eggs and maybe some cereal. And the eggs had like a tan color to them. But when you cracked them open, they would just be brown, slimy, smelling. They smelled rancid. And, you know, there was a few instances. There were a couple of COs there. They were actually decent people. And they did document this stuff. But, you know, that all that stuff would just go away. Like it would get swept under the rug. You know, several times bad dinner trays would come in. You know, sometimes it'd be like tuna salad, and it just smell rancid. And so, I mean, we ended up stockpiling commissary food to, you know, subset the harsh, man, we wouldn't eat the food. But yeah, it was bad. I mean, that was probably one of the worst facilities I was in as far as living conditions treatment goes. I mean, all jails and prisons, they're all kind of inherently dirty because of the kind of culture that they have in them. You know what I mean? They, you know, a lot, especially in places that house like state inmates and stuff, a lot of people, they just don't care about their living conditions. They're going from one facility or the other, and the jail's not cleaning it up. They expect the inmates to clean up after themselves, and they don't. But, you know, they should still come in and sanitize. They should still do certain things, and they just don't do it in that aspect. DC was probably, like I said, the worst. Now, Northern Neck was real bad. In Northern Neck, we lived for like 3 weeks at least with backed up sewer lines, because the floors had drains in them and it was all tied into the sewer lines. The sewer line collapsed, so all the sewer backed up and flooded the unit. So you had feces and dirty water floating around everywhere. And it was just like, they didn't even care. They just, you know,
The DC jail, I want to remind our audience, when you're in the DC jail, that's even before trial. So technically, like, I know a lot of people at home are like, well, that's just jail or prison. No, it's not, because you're innocent until you're proven guilty in this country. And so you shouldn't have to endure those type of living conditions, I think, at all. But especially when you're somebody who's supposed to be presumed innocent at first, how did that make you feel, just having to live like that?
It was, you know, being prior service military, you learn how to adapt and overcome in certain adverse situations. So in D.C., the best thing I ended up doing was becoming part of like the orderly crew that was on the unit in D.C. So we cleaned up the best we could and tried to keep the unit sanitized the best we could with what they would give us. But then you still have the mold in the food and, you know, just, I mean, you locked in your cell sometimes for a month, 2 months, and no officers aren't out there cleaning. So when you come out at the end of, you know, 60 days being locked down, you spend a week trying to clean up to get the smell out, because it inherently, it's like damp in there, and it just, it gets real musky smelling. And just, plus they were having sewer issues too. So they were always toilets overflowing, sinks overflowing. So we were always having to clean that stuff up. But like early on, it was in bad shape. You know, after, you know, 2 years of cleaning in there, we got it kind of livable, but it was still the mold issues and, you know, the toilets constantly overflowing. So it was pretty rough.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Ken, I wanted to jump into your trial because it was actually one of probably the most publicized trials out of all these J6 trials. And it's because you were on trial with a group of individuals, one of them being Stuart Rhodes, the founder, the leader of the Oath Keepers at the time. And you weren't alone. It was you, Kelly Meggs, Jessica Watskin, and Thomas Caldwell. And it was an interesting group because, well, that's a lot of people to put on trial at once. You guys all weren't together that day. In fact, did you even know Tom prior to the trial?
No, I didn't meet Thomas Caldwell until the first day of the trial.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things, because I've spoken with, you know, Stuart Rhodes' attorneys, and we've talked about this, this effort by the DOJ to put all of you on trial together, even though it's completely separate cases. And ultimately what that does is it makes it really hard for a jury to be able to separate what they're accusing each of you of, and you're all as a group being found guilty. Yeah.
At the time, I think there was over 25 co-defendants, and they broke it down, you know, into groups. I mean, there was no rhyme or reason by why they did it. Their claim was the logistics and the expediencies of the trials. It was better to break them down into groups. And, you know, so, but yeah, to Thomas Caldwell, I had never met him. I'd only met Jess once before. And really I'd only met Stuart once before the event.
Well, I think it's interesting. So just to kind of condense everything regarding the trial, Stuart never went into the Capitol, and Stuart was sentenced to 18 years in prison. You did go into the Capitol. Again, it's hard to even wrap your mind around, especially in D.C. I mean, I've seen, we were going through the rape cases in D.C., and the DOJ wasn't even asking anywhere near 18 years for a lot of these rapists. But somebody who was nonviolent that day, who they're lying about when they say that he orchestrated all of this, is sadly sitting in prison for 18 years.
It's preposterous, you know. Like, let me give you a scenario, right? Ray Epps, right? Multiple videos of him, you know, trying to get people to go into the building on the day before, morning of. We're going to the Capitol. We're going into the Capitol. We're going into the building. When we came out of the building and we told Stuart that we helped the police officer and that, you know, we didn't see anything really violent take place. Stuart Rhodes looked at us and went, well, that was kind of stupid. You should have never done that. And it was like, well, the doors just opened. What we did, were we not allowed to go into the building? You know what I mean? So, but that's just to kind of like look at things, you know what I mean? Stuart Rhodes, you know, he didn't go into the building. You know, he told us we were stupid for doing it. He gets 18 years. Ray Epps tells people to go into the building multiple different times on video footage, and he's hidden off in the Rocky Mountains in a camper somewhere. You know what I mean? So it's just, I don't know.
It's disturbing. I mean, I've spoken to Stuart and he didn't say anything stupid, but he did say that both you and Megs probably shouldn't have gone in there. But he was very nice about it. He wasn't mean. But I mean, again, that highlights this fact that you were just saying that he didn't encourage you guys to go in and he didn't orchestrate all of you going into the Capitol, which is the DOJ's argument. And then I also wanted to add, you know, I had Stuart Rhodes' attorneys on our program and we detailed what was going on specifically with the accusations he was facing. And you echoed the same thing. And I've heard this time and time again. You guys didn't have a signal, a cell phone signal. And so what that means is that they're saying that somehow Stuart Rhodes was outside of the Capitol orchestrating everything, even with you guys, but there's no possible way to do so if you don't have a signal. So tell our audience, what was the reception like that day regarding your cell phone service?
So there was no service on the cell phones. And in fact, we didn't start getting service back on our cell phones till about 7 or 8 o'clock that evening. I was sitting, you know, having an adult beverage with one of the guys, and my phone just started going off, just bing, 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 all these messages and text messages. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? And I looked at my phone and I was receiving messages that had been sent at like 11:30 a.m. in the morning, but I just never received any of them, you know. And you know, it just, and it's funny because some of the messages and stuff that they tried to use during the trial weren't even received until later that evening, you know. And it just like, it, I've never been there before, so I don't know how the, you know, signal is around the area, around the building and stuff, but it was weird. It was almost like they flipped the switch and said, all right, we can get service activate back again, because it was, like I said, you know, I'd have been sitting in the same location for a few hours and my phone had never went off. And then all of a sudden it just starts pinging and going off with all these messages, and made me kind of raise my eyebrows. You know what I mean? Like, this is kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, I was actually just going to ask you this, because I've only heard the cell phone issue with the Oath Keepers. Was there anybody else in the jail who said while they were either around the Capitol or in the Capitol that they didn't have cell phone reception?
Yeah. Yeah. Several guys, you know, talking about the, you know, that day and everything. A lot of the guys said that either when they got close to the building or at a certain time, their cell phone signals just fell off and they didn't come back until later that evening.
And were those individuals, were they Oath Keepers or Proud Boys, or were they just regular citizens?
No, they were just guys in the jail. So it was like, it was a group of us in the jail that did, you know, extensive research, video research. And we would compare our, you know, we would compare our, you know, what happened that day. And, you know, like just going over, trying to figure out the, you know, what really took place that day. You know what I mean? Because it was, you know, early on, it was just the way it was the narrative, and the way they spun it, you know. And a lot of those guys never saw any of that stuff that they used in, you know, in the video footage. And, you know, it's, unless you're packed in a crowd with a lot of people, you don't really understand what's going on. But if you're in a crowd of thousands of people, you can't see 3 or 4 people in front of you what's going on 50 foot. You just, it's, there's no way, you know what I mean? So a lot of those guys that were there that day didn't see any, I mean, they knew about, a lot of them didn't know what really happened till after the fact.
You know what I mean? And that's understandable. It was chaos. There was chaos like I said, everywhere.
It was a group of us trying to figure it out, you know. Mm-hmm. We had nothing better to do.
Yeah, they gave you guys time to figure it all out. I mean, the stories are just gut-wrenching. But Ken, I mean, our audience, specifically for you, really resonates when we were detailing what happened to you, because you were there that day. Number one, I want to drive home this point. You're not a political person, so you did not vote in the election. Have you ever voted in an election?
No, not. I voted in one state election, and that was it. But as far as, you know, federal elections, I never voted in federal elections. And it goes back to being raised in like a military family, where it's always been like, well, the president's the president, you know, and you don't have to respect the person that's in the seat. You respect the seat itself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You don't have to pay attention as long as I just never really was political. You know what I mean? Like, I had better things to do. I had to go fishing and barbecue and work and ride my motorcycle and work on my hot rods. You know what I mean? I was just yeah. After the military, of course. But
yeah. Well, I mean, that's fair. I think that most people would understand that. I think people are like, well, why is he there that day? But I also, before we get into that, I want to also ask you, Ken, obviously as a service member, you've served this country proudly. Why did you decide to join the Oath Keepers in the first place?
Well, being from Florida, mm-hmm. we're in Hurricane Alley. And so we had a real bad hurricane and there was nothing here for like a week. You couldn't get emergency services. You couldn't get, you know, the things you needed and stuff of that nature. So I started researching like disaster relief organizations I could get into for disaster relief. And nothing was really coming up in the Google search engines. And the two top, and when every time I'd search, the two top things were the Florida militia, the state militia for Florida, and the Oath Keepers. Mm-hmm. And so I started out with the state militia. I went on their website, applied. I never heard anything back. Not one peep for almost a year. So I'm back on the computer, Googling disaster relief again, and Oath Keepers keep popping up. So I click on the website, and the first thing that popped up was the Oath Keepers are a nonpartisan group of ex-military, law enforcement, and first responders who are out in the community, helping the community to be prepared for any kind of disasters or any type of, you know, whenever the system goes down, whether it be prepping, you know, being able to go purify your own water, get your own food, whatever it is. And that's the way it was marketed. And they had a thing called community preparedness teams. And that's all the things on the community preparedness team checked all the blocks is for what I was looking for, because I like to teach people things and I also like to learn new things. So I looked at it as an opportunity to connect with, you know, former military, law enforcement, and first responders that may have had a different skill set or job than what I had in the military. So I could learn from those guys and then also teach the civilian population at large how to do some of these things to be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah, well, that's fair, honestly. I think that's fair, especially from what I've heard of, you know, you and I were limited with being able to speak, and everyone I spoke to said that was really a main reason why you joined and so many others joined the Oath Keepers. And it's interesting because when you hear about it in the media will report that the Oath Keepers is a militia group. And I started off covering J6 very neutral just because I didn't really have any type of, I didn't really care for it, honestly. Like, I didn't care emotionally about either side of the argument. But then as I started talking to people, I realized doing my own research, they'll call in a militia group. They'll make it sound like it's violent in the corporate media. But I kept asking, what violent things have these guys ever been a part of? Because there should be video of it. And there was never any video of it. And there was never any violence that you guys participated in. And in fact, you guys were there that day, from my understanding, to provide security to speakers. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, we were there to provide security for a group of speakers. They were scheduled to be on the east side of the Capitol. Mm-hmm. We were running late, but they had permitted grounds. I can't remember what section it was, but it was on the east lawn of the Capitol. That's the whole reason why I was there, and you know, the other guys were there, you know.
Yeah. Well, Ken, this makes sense, because when we talk about why you joined the Oath Keepers and why you were there that day, it makes sense when you hear about your interaction with Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn. Harry Dunn is one of the individuals who did initially give you guys a great review for helping him out, but then that miraculously disappeared and his story completely shifted. Now, before I get into the details about that, I want to remind our audience that I've spoken with people, Ken, that you don't know personally. You've never met them. You've actually still to this day haven't spoken to them. People like Stephen Horn, for example, who was a journalist reporting that day, and he specifically said, I watched what happened between Ken and Kelly Meggs, and they were helping out Officer Dunn, but that individual, Stephen Horn, felt so uncomfortable about the interaction that you guys were having with Harry Dunn, because Harry Dunn was so tense and was so poorly trained and was unable to handle the situation. It did look like, in fact, he was going to potentially commit an act of violence against these protesters. And so that individual actually left. So you got that same gut instinct that you did that day. And that same gut instinct, though, for you, a trained professional, was to intervene. And for our audience, we've spoken about it here on this show. I'll let you detail it though personally so they could hear you say it. But Officer Harry Dunn has completely changed his story. So tell our audience, how did the interaction between you and Officer Dunn initially begin? And why did you take it upon yourself to step in and help him out that day?
All right. Yeah. So when we were in the rotunda, and Kelly saw a gentleman fall on the floor. So we all kind of gravitated over there towards him, and he was just, he was ecstatic. We thought like something was wrong with him. So we all kind of converged on him to help him. And he was crying. He was ecstatic. He was excited. And so he asked us to say a prayer with him. So we all actually said, we said a prayer with him, got him stood up, and, we all kind of migrated over to the entrance to a hallway, and we were just kind of looking around, you know, watching, seeing what was going on. And one of the guys slipped. He heard a commotion down the hallway, and he slipped down the hallway. And a few moments later, he come back up and he said, he grabbed me by the shirt and he says, "Hey man, there's something going on down here. There's a cop. There's a cop down here, and it doesn't look too good." And I said, "All right." So I told the guy, "So you stay here. I'll go down and check it out." So I moved down the hallway and I positioned myself across the hallway from the officer and the crowd and watched the interaction. Well, they wanted to go down a staircase that he was standing at the top of. And, they said, they were saying things like, "We know they're down there. We know the politicians are down there. Let us go down there." And, he's a big guy. He's standing there. He's got his M4 at the low ready, gripping it real tight, just bug eyed. And he's like, "I can't let you guys go down there." And, it got into the whole like voting conversation about he voted for Joe Biden and they were trying to silence his vote. And they said, "Well, if you don't, If you don't move out of the way and let us down this staircase, we're going to drag you out of here and hang you with the rest of the politicians."
Wow.
And he said, "Well, if you try to get me out of here, I'm going to take as many of you out with me as I can before you get me out of here." And he had his rifle in his hand. He was pulling it up. And at that moment, I said that this guy's fixing to open fire on this crowd. If they try, because he wasn't de-escalating. He was antagonistic in the way he was reacting with the crowd. You know, he should have never been saying anything about him voting for Joe Biden or who he voted for. If those people weren't allowed to be in that building, he should have been telling them to leave the building. You know what I mean? He should have been saying, you guys need to get out of here. You're breaking the law. You shouldn't be in here. I can't let you go down these stairs. It's off limits. You're trespassing, things of that nature. But he never said that. Those words never came out of his mouth. That's when you see the video of me step forward. And I say, hey, what are you doing, man? What's going on here? And he says, after that, he said, well, they're attacking cops. They're carrying my brothers out of here on stretchers. It's chaos. And I told him, I said, just sit tight. I'll be right back. So I ran down. I didn't run because it was short distance, but I speed walked back down and grabbed Kelly. And I said, Kelly, we got to do something, man. This cop's down here. He's in distress. We need to get down here and get between him and these protesters and stop whatever interaction is going on. So we did that. We moved down and you see there's pictures everywhere. You know, you see Kelly's kind of talking to him, trying to calm him down. We formed a line up in front of him. And when we did that, the protesters turned on us. They were saying that we were trying to protect him. We were trying to protect the politicians and that we were tyrants just like the rest of them. And we should be with them. And, I kept telling the guys, I said, look, don't interact with them. Just stand there, keep your mouth shut. We'll form a line. If anybody tries to get at the officer, we'll stop them. We'll do whatever we have to do to keep people away from him until other officers arrive. And that's what we did.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's interesting that everyone should hear that from you directly, because again, folks, I've asked around and those were the same details that we heard from other people. But that's not what we heard, unfortunately, Ken, during your trial. It was very disturbing because I reached out to Steve Baker, the journalist over at The Blaze, and because Steve was sitting in your courtroom while this was all taking place. And yeah, it was very strange to hear the judge in your case and Will Distance being critical of him. But I would say it was very interesting to hear how Judge Mehta shut down any type of evidence coming forward that the statement that was about to be made or was made by Officer Harry Dunn during your trial, I should say, was going to be different from what was originally claimed by that same officer. Now, the disturbing part in all of this, folks, and if you haven't been covering this, let me give you the rundown here. Steve Baker, that journalist I just spoke about, has been doing massive amounts of digging into all of this. And it's interesting enough because it wasn't just Officer Harry Dunn who claimed that he had a negative interaction with you guys and that it didn't go how you just detailed it. But then there was another officer, Officer David Lazarus, who also testified and gave testimony that was not factually correct, according to Baker. And Baker's been able to prove that by going through the surveillance footage and just pretty much finding that Lazarus was not in the area at the time that this incident took place. In fact, he was nowhere near the area. He was on the other side of the building. And so with all of this surveillance footage pieced together, it's very obvious that David Lazarus was added into your trial as a witness to back up Harry Dunn's claim. But Harry's Dunn claim that he made during your trial was completely different from the original claims that were made. And so what I'm getting at here, folks, is that the DOJ put two witnesses on the stand that they knew were not being honest and were not being truthful about these interactions, and that there was potentially a document that was originally given by Harry Dunn that differed the testimony that was given on that stand. So I want to ask you, Ken, you obviously paid the consequences of it. And sadly, Kelly Meggs is as well. I believe Kelly was sentenced to over 10 years in prison, if I'm right, or is it 12 years?
No. Yeah, he was sentenced to 12 years.
12 years in prison. And again, folks, you just heard Ken detail the fact that he did not do any violence that day. In fact, that he tried to help Ken when Ken was trying to help out Officer Dunn. I want to talk to you about two things. Number one, he's running for Congress now, Officer Harry Dunn. He, in fact, was endorsed by Nancy Pelosi just last week. So we'll get into that in just a moment. But I want your reaction to having to sit there as a defendant and hearing him tell a lie about you and your character. How do you feel about that? Because that's ultimately one of the deciding factors that landed you in prison for over 3 years.
Yeah, it was hard. It was a hard pill to swallow, you know. Not being able to really contradict his story was a hard pill to swallow because of, like you said, the fact that they wouldn't let the documents in that, you know, previous to the story he told on the stand. You know, but it's part of the machine. That's the way that's the way that things are run up there. You know, and one of the things I can say is one of the good things that has come out of all this is it shed a light to the American public about how that district operates and how things are done up there in a certain way. You know, and I say the district up there, but after being in prison and, you know, interacting with other, you know, alleged criminals that almost had kind of like the same type of thing happen to them in other districts of America. And it kind of made me realize that it's the system as a whole is broken.
Yeah. But no, it is.
It was definitely a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. And it shouldn't be happening. And when the evidence emerged regarding, first off, and our audience, just keep you also in the loop in this, you didn't have access really to the surveillance footage regarding David Lazarus, the officer who I just detailed was not in the area at the time of the incident that he detailed on the stand and claimed that he witnessed. So it's really hard for you to debunk him, especially when the judge is making you all handicap by not bringing in any of the claims that Officer Dunn did previously make in writing. So that really handicaps your legal defense. But the fact also that we, the public, have not had access to this footage, and this could have helped you out significantly.
Yeah. Well, one thing, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but when they put, you know, Lazarus on the stand, you know, me and Kelly both kind of raised eyebrows, and we were like, where did this guy come from? So we listened to his testimony and his story. So we found one piece of footage where he says he was when he actually wasn't, but we found like the footage of him going to that location, just, you know, and Steve's done great work. You know, Steve he's uncovered the whole trail, you know, because we didn't have access to a lot of the footage that Steve has dug up and found and presented to the American people to prove that, you know, to debunk the story. But so the following day, one of the attorneys, I believe it was Meg's attorney, wanted to bring Lazarus back to try to impeach his testimony. And they wouldn't allow us to do that. They said that it would be next to impossible for these two police officers to get scheduled time off to come back to be put back on the stand. But what was odd about that was, you know, Harry Dunn had been sitting there for two or three weeks already watching, you know, sitting there in the courtroom, you know, so, you know, they, you know, and the DOJ actively blocked us to prevent us to be able to impeach his testimony because they knew how damning it sounded the way they presented it to the jury, you know?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you just to be more specific about the footage. So you're saying that there was a piece of footage. Did that footage put him in the room with you guys when the interaction took place?
No, it was CCTV footage in the lower part of the Capitol of him approaching and going up that staircase. Okay. Now, granted, that was a few minutes after we were gone already.
So, yeah. So it wasn't during the interaction. Okay. So I want to drive that home. No. Okay.
No, he was never there during the interaction. We were out of the building before he even arrived at the bottom of that staircase and went up that staircase to where Harry Dunn was. We were already out. We were already gone and out of the building. Because once, so what happened was we were there, we're done, and some Capitol Police came up in riot gear. And one of the guys pushed past Harry Dunn and grabbed Kelly Meggs by the arm and said, "Hey, we got this under control. You guys get out of here." And that's when we said, "Okay, we'll get out of here," because we didn't like what we were seeing, the way some of the protesters were acting and some of the things they were saying. It just didn't fall in line with what we thought. It just didn't. Something was off. You know what I mean? Like, we didn't. We thought something was off about what was going on. You know what I mean? So we as soon as that guy came up and said that, we cut out of the building.
Yeah. Well, that's on this show especially. I mean, I have turned down interviews with certain people that I do believe were violent that day, because we do not support that at all. And I think that's the critical point in all of this. It's why your story, I think, really pulls people's heartstrings, because they know that you weren't there that day to cause problems or to harm other individuals. You were just there that day authentically to help out other people. And that's what your main job was that day. I want to ask you, though, because, you know, Steve Baker's reporting has followed this through. We know now, obviously, that Officer Harry Dunn is running for Congress and has just gotten endorsed by Nancy Pelosi. But Officer David Lazarus tried actually leaving Capitol Police randomly. And for some reason, according to Steve Baker, he was not able to be transferred to another department. What's your feeling on all of this with Dunn now running for Congress in Maryland and then, you know, Officer Lazarus looking to bounce and leave Capitol Police?
Right. Well, I don't know the time frame of Lazarus trying to leave the Capitol Police, but I would think that maybe he might be worried that he's caught in telling a story and trying to get out of being held accountable for it. That's one possible thing. Or he could just be trying to move on to bigger and better things. We'll never really know, but the timing of it all is kind of suspicious to me, you know. But as far as, you know, Harry Dunn is concerned running for Congress, all I can say is that, you know, people need to pay very close attention to who they vote for, you know. And it's not just Democrats, it's Republicans too, you know what I mean? And not to go off on a political thing, I wasn't political before this happened, but this whole situation has forced me to pay more attention to what is going on. And, you know, these politicians in general, a lot of them are fooling a lot of American people. You know what I mean? And just, you know, having that endorsement by Nancy Pelosi, you know, is going to boost him. No matter, people are going to say, "Well, he just told a little fib," or he, you know, it doesn't matter that he lied. Those were Trump supporters. So, you know what I mean? So it's just the whole, to me, the whole political environment is a mess. It's not the way the founding fathers intended it to be. And it's sometimes it's sickening to watch, you know? So I try not to, you know, while I was incarcerated, especially in DC, there was a lot of political, you know, because, you know, a lot of those guys were political. So the TVs were always on the political stuff and political news. And so I had to, you know, I had to swallow a lot of it. And you know, like I said, this whole thing has made me pay a lot more attention to what's going on as far as politics are concerned. So yeah. I've learned a lot. I've had a crash course in it.
Yeah. And it's not one that you, I'm sure, expected. I wanted to bring up too. So obviously you were convicted, and before sentencing, you stood in front of Judge Mehta, and you know, Judge Mehta did make the claim that he doesn't believe the prosecutors, that that you're the person that they're trying to portray you to be. But then he did sentence you to a few years in prison. And then on top of it, he added a terrorist enhancement, the enhancement, which many of our audience thought was extremely cruel. I myself thought so as well, and shouldn't be applied to any of your cases, because that's not what it was intended to be added for. But Ken, you know, you served our country proudly. You've gone overseas. You've done your duties for this nation. How did it feel to have a DC court refer to you and slap a terrorist enhancement onto your case?
It was a hard pill to swallow. The one thing that, you know, like I said, you know, I know I'm pretty good at adapting to situations and overcoming certain things. So, you know, all I can do is live life the best I can. And, you know, there were already some appellate issues around those terrorism enhancements. And I feel like there's going to be a lot more coming up, you know, but, you know, it doesn't matter what DC says about me. I come from a long line of prior service military. You know, I have over 100+ years of history of military in my family. I love America. Sometimes the government is like a dysfunctional family, but regardless, I still love this country. And, you know, I hope the one day that the government is ran in a way that it's meant to be ran. You know, until that day, we're just going to have to sit back and watch the show, but they can label me whatever they want to. You know what I mean? My brothers in arms know better. My friends, my family know better. And, you know, hopefully the America knows better than, you know, to pay attention to these kind of things that they're doing. I know there was a few of those guys before the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys cases that got that enhancement. But their main thing, I think, with the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and putting those enhancements on it, on us particularly, was they were just trying to make a point. You know, you act out and, you know, you this is what we're going to do to you. You know, the shock and awe.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, people look at like Stuart Rhodes, for example, and think he was just some kind of crazy radical. They don't realize that Stuart was a Yale Law School graduate. You know, he had plaques on their walls for his constitutional knowledge as far as, you know, the law and the Constitution goes. He worked at the Capitol as a congressional aide, you know. Kelly Meggs was a grandfather, and all he cared about was his community. You know, Jess was a former Army Ranger, multiple combat deployments. You know, Thomas Caldwell was the same way. He was in the Navy, you know, and so we all were pretty much the same way. Like, this is just part of their labeling. They like to label people as things, you know, but I come from background sticks and stones, so, you know.
Yeah. It shouldn't be happening, though. I mean, no. This should not be the case, and it should be overturned. But then we have, you know, Matthew Graves' office saying that if anyone gets those enhancements tossed, that they're going to go back and ask for more time on their lesser charges, which is egregious in itself. And it should be really catching the eye of the Supreme Court, because that's their way of sticking it to the Supreme Court or any other appeals court that is just standing up for our rule of law system that we have in this country. And so it's deplorable that they even are comfortable enough to publicly state those things. But I want to get back to the folks who you were on trial with, because I think that's really important. You know, Thomas Caldwell, his health, from what I've been told, isn't very good right now. And so he's still awaiting his sentencing because of that. Jessica Watkins, I know she was sentenced to a couple of years. Was she 8 years?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Jess was sentenced to 8 years.
Yeah. So she's sentenced to 8 years right now. As we spoke about earlier, Kelly Meggs, who you were with in the Capitol, was sentenced to 12 years, and Stewart was slapped with 18 years in prison. When you sat there and heard what they were all sentenced to, what was your gut instinct on that? Because I cannot imagine what you were thinking.
I was worried, you know, because in my opinion, they didn't really present a strong case for the charges, for one. And then nobody committed any violence. I mean, Jess was accused of being violent you know, and admitted to being part of a crowd that was pushing back against a shield wall that the Capitol Police had up in a hallway. But Jess wasn't spraying people with pepper spray, and Jess didn't actively assault a police officer. So I think the charge ended up being something to do with some kind of riot. The extra charge that Jess got. I believe that, you know, Megs and Rhodes, you know, those dudes, they don't deserve what they got, you know, in my opinion. You know, it's still kind of rough to think about. Because here's the thing, is that they use the same tactics that they used against us in our trial. 98% of Americans are guilty of crimes. If they can go through Facebook posts and pick and choose Facebook posts, pick and choose chats, and not even follow the chat, you know, pick this comment, go down 10 days later, pick this comment, go down 5 days later, pick this comment, and take all of those comments out of context, but use them to build a narrative that they want to try and convict somebody, you know, then you know, it spells trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the reason why, you know, Enrique Tarrio, who I speak to also, he was sentenced to 22 years in prison and he wasn't even at the rally. They instead selected what text messages to use against him and they prosecuted him in front of a biased DC jury, and he was convicted and sent to jail for 22 years. And he's in the mountains in Kentucky where, you know, anyone is going to struggle to see him again if he's not transferred out. Yeah. But it's intentional. And you have free speech and I have free speech. And just because we say something that the government disagrees with doesn't mean we belong in prison. It doesn't mean that we belong in a cell and have to endure the condition that you detailed for us today. And so it's heartbreaking, Ken, that this is what's going on in our country. Now, I believe that a lot of this will get overturned by the Supreme Court, but the aggression that the U.S. Attorney Matthew Graves' office is showing and going back and challenging these things, if it does get overturned, it's stressful. I mean, it's the reason why, sadly, Matthew Perna took his own life, because he thought he was going in for a plea deal and was going to spend a couple of months in prison for walking and taking a tour through the Capitol. And instead, they added the terrorist enhancement and told him that he might go to jail for 6 years. And that stress alone did not sit well on his heart. And so, sadly, he's not the only one. There's been several of them. And they continue to do all of this, Ken, and there's no repercussions for them because, well, it's very expensive to fund your defense, and they have endless resources. So, you know, before we wrap this up for our audience, what's the takeaway?
Plus, they're getting bonuses for getting these convictions. Let's not forget about that. The U.S. Attorney's Office, those prosecutors are getting bonuses. The FBI is getting bonuses, all the way down the line. They're getting bonuses for picking up, you know, people that they deem, you know, if they deem you as, like, if they say, oh, well, you were at January 6th, you could be possibly a domestic terrorist. Well, that pings the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So that puts a whole task force of people whose sole purpose should be rounding up terrorists from a foreign land on American soil to do bad things to American people. But instead, they're rounding up grandma, because they're getting a $10,000 bonus for that. You know, I don't know if that's how much it is, but I'm just using that number. But they're getting these large bonuses to just scoop these people up, you know. And then half of the people on these terrorism task force now, that wasn't even their job in the FBI. They were finance crimes or, you know, they were child sex crimes, and they bring them into these task force because that's what they label all these people as, and then that's how they can use the big bucks and the big guns to go after, you know, American citizens.
Yeah, I mean, and you just detailed that. We have here in Florida Steve Friend, the FBI whistleblower who left the agency for exactly what you detailed there. He did not want to keep banging down the front doors of people who showed up to rally and were charged with misdemeanors, because he was actually was focused on, in his previous project, what was going after pedophiles and saving children. And instead of being able to do that, they put him to J6, and it was just politically motivated. And so he ended up blowing the whistle on the FBI for that reason alone. So there's some good, but I mean, that's one agent in a sea full of hundreds who have refused to come step forward and just speak out on the behalf of Americans who are now being forced to deal with an FBI that's weaponized completely against them and being used for political reasons. Ken, before we wrap this, I wanted you to give our audience kind of a departing message from this interview, but mainly just like kind of like how are you feeling? Are you hopeful that we could flip this thing around and get justice for you and others who were wronged by our justice system? Any type of message of hope?
Yeah, you know, I keep hope. That's the only way to push forward, you know. And, you know, it's sad that, you know, I understand the stresses of the situation far too well, you know, and I know it's hard, you know. So anybody out there that's going through this stuff, just keep your head up and know that they're hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people out there who support you like they did me and my family. You know, without the American people's support, you know, not just with me, but with my wife, you know, because she was my rock in all this, you know, so she had the support she needed to support me, which allowed me to be able to focus on what I needed to do while being in prison to not lose myself. Because it is hard, but I have extreme hope that things will change, you know. And I would like to thank, you know, my wife first and foremost for her support and the millions of Americans out there. And also I had some sponsors that are very near and dear to my heart. Their names, I'm not going to say their last names, but their names, Ted, Janine, Joy, Autumn, and Joshua. And, you know, they didn't donate any money, but they donated a part of their life to me. They set up a mail room and their kids wrote me at least five letters a day from these kids. And it was just like, I could be having the worst day of my life sitting in that jail cell and get those letters from that family. And it would just, I mean, they reached out, you know, they didn't write a lot of the other J6ers, but their oldest daughter, Autumn, she's an artist. So she was doing drawings and they were putting them in the envelopes and I'd hand them out to all the guys because she did little caricatures of everybody. So, I mean, it was, you know, that in itself, that, you know, that speaks volumes to, you know, that things aren't as bad out, you know, people aren't as bad out there as they would make you believe, because in DC it was, you know, they wanted you to believe that you were alone. You know, the whole point of the solitary confinement, not being allowed to see your family for 2 years, not providing haircuts and not allowing you to shave, and, you know, that was all a part of the plan to dehumanize you and make you give in and to break you. And without American support, without the support of America, my family, and, you know, that, you know, the sponsors and everything else, a lot of those guys, myself included, would probably, it was bad, but that in itself is what allowed people like me to persevere and push through and stay strong and come out the other end, like ready to continue to fight. Because I have not only my brothers and everyone that's involved in J6, but after being incarcerated in the BOP and seeing some of those guys and what they've been through and what the government's put them through. I mean, there's so many guys in there that are innocent, and they use these conspiracy charges to pull people into federal felony criminal cases that, in other words, were not criminals. They didn't have anything to do with these particular crimes, but maybe their phone was in this person's contact list. They were in this person's contact list, and they refused to lie for the DOJ to convict these people. So they turn around and put conspiracy charges on them. And then they put co-defendants together on conspiracy charges and offer them deals to get them to turn on each other. And it's just, the whole system is it needs an overhaul. And that's one of the things that this has opened my eyes up to. But back to what we were talking about. So I'll go off on tangents all day.
It's okay. We got the time.
But, the outpouring of support is what helped, and it's sad to think that the DOJ gets to people to the point to where they would end their own lives. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And what they do is they see a weakness, a point of weakness, and they try to exploit it to break people,
They do.
But thank you, America. Thank you to your watchers, and thank you for, advocating for us. And, it's just great to be home.
It's great to have you home, Sergeant Ken Harrelson. And we're so happy that you're back. And, for our audience at home, if you have a question for Ken, we're going to have him back on the program. So feel free to leave it in the comments as well. Or if you just have a message of hope or anything you'd like to say, leave that there. We will make sure that he gets it. We'll read it to him. Because he can't use, I don't think you can use social media. So somebody will read it to you, I'm sure. But Ken, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time, and we're so, so happy you're back home with your great wife and your pups. And we're just happy and happy and happy and happy to see that you're here. Because it's been, look, there she is, the lady. Yep. The boss lady. This woman, right? Ken, gave everyone a heck. I mean, all the right people. She pressed them. She went after them. She wanted answers. She'd make a great journalist, I must say.
Yeah. You never know. I might join you, Brianna.
You never know. You never know. Ken and Angel, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if you enjoyed that segment, make sure you hit that subscribe button right now and turn on your notifications, because we got a ton of exclusive interviews that you won't see anywhere else dropping soon. So make sure you have your notifications on. And if you're looking to support our content, we greatly appreciate you doing so. Head over to supportbree.com. That's supportbree.com. That's where you can make a donation for whatever dollar amount you'd like, either a one-time donation or become a monthly donor. Obviously, this is an independent platform, so we greatly appreciate whatever you give. So again, folks, it's supportbree.com. You get to pick the dollar amount, and you could pick when you want that coming out of your account. It really does help us out significantly. Like I said, we're not taking money from Big Pharma or any of those sketchy little companies. We're specifically funded by you, the viewers. So thank you for helping us out over at supportbree.com. We'll be right back with more. I want to let our audience in on a little secret. I'm saving hundreds of dollars each year after switching over both of my lines to Patriot Mobile. Yes, so now my business and personal line are with Patriot Mobile. Now, Patriot Mobile uses the same towers that you're probably already using now, except it's less expensive. So my 5G towers that I love to use my old provider, I'm still using them now. I'm just paying significantly less money to do so. And on top of it all, Patriot Mobile believes in the same things you and I believe in. They have the same morals. So they donate to causes that are like pro-life causes, veteran causes, and even the NRA. It's incredible. So I highly recommend you head over to patriotmobile.com right now, take a look at their plans, and sign up. And today, if you sign up and use promo code Brianna, they're going to waive the activation fee. Yes, you heard it right. They're going to waive the activation fee. Just make sure you use promo code Brianna, B-R-E-A-N-N-A. John Sullivan has been sentenced to 6 years in prison. Now, many of you might remember John Sullivan is the individual who a lot of you thought was Antifa, and he was, and from the video we could prove it, was a BLM supporter. He was at the Capitol on January 6th and went inside the Capitol, and we know this because he filmed it, and he has now been sentenced, of course, to 6 years in prison. He was found guilty of felony obstruction, which so many J6ers are going through, and he, as you see in this video, took the video of Ashley Babbitt being shot inside the Capitol. And he sold that footage to NBC and CNN. Before we dive into that, it's really important to understand who he is, because so many people have been talking about who John Sullivan is. There's a lot of rumors out there, and we wanted to go through all of them. So let's talk about the first thing. Well, obviously, you see the footage. He did sell his footage to CNN and MSNBC. But then there was also John Sullivan, who was a BLM supporter and who did make violent threats while at these rallies. Let's take a listen.
What's going on, everybody? My name's John Sullivan. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. My group is Insurgents USA. We're about to burn this down. Anybody out here seeing that white militia guy shoot three kids? Yeah. That guy. And I will tell you, this is in Utah. A whole bunch of white militia came out there, formed against our group. We out there strapped. We out there ready to burn that down. We out there to defend ourselves. We got to defend ourselves now, too. We do. Because power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Right. We got rip Trump out of that office right over there. Pull him out that shit. Nah, we ain't about waiting until the next election. We about to go get that motherfucker.
So you heard him there. There were a lot of threats and a lot of curse words, of course. But again, folks, this is America. There is free speech involved here. Now, the DOJ, regarding his appearance on January 6th, did release this statement after he was convicted, saying, according to evidence presented during the trial, Sullivan was wearing a ballistic vest and a gas mask. He joined rioters storming the U.S. Capitol, where he filmed a crowd pushing through several police barriers on the west side of the Capitol. It pretty much goes on to saying what his role was that day and how he was calling for, rally folks to get a little crazy. And in fact, that's what they did. Now, when they entered the Capitol, Sullivan was very excited to be gathering the footage, and this is how it went.
We did it.
I was trying to tell you. I couldn't say much.
You were right.
You just have to wash my tongue. Is this not going to be the best film you've ever made in your life? Hell yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Hell yeah.
So that was him inside the Capitol discussing what they were doing. And, well, obviously, moments later, he did witness and film the shooting of Ashley Babbitt. Joining us to discuss all things John Sullivan is The Blaze, one of the best people over at The Blaze, I'd say, one of the best investigative reporters, Steve Baker. Steve, thank you for joining us. Listen, I mean, you and I have been chatting all weekend after he was sentenced to 6 years in prison. A lot of people are skeptical still of his role in January 6th, and they've thrown around terms like Fed or even a CNN employee. So I wanted to bring you on to talk about John Sullivan specifically, because you followed him through his trial, spoke to his family, and have gone through all of this. So what do you make of John Sullivan? Is he a Fed?
I do not believe that he's a Fed. Can I tell anybody with 100% absolute certainty that he's not? No, of course not. I mean, that's the whole thing about being a Fed or a spook or a spy or CIA op or, you know, any type of intelligence operative, is to be secret about it and to have the right kind of, spycraft in order to keep that, a mystery. But the reality is that nothing in his behavior, nothing in his background, nothing in his actions leading up to January 6th gives any indication of that whatsoever, not to mention the fact that I watched with my own eyes the government prosecutors go after him with long knives. I mean, they were going to take him out. At first, I didn't think so. In the early first couple of days of the trial, I thought they were mailing it in. But what I saw was them holding back and waiting for the kill. moment, and they went in for the kill when it was time. And as a result of that, I mean, the judge, Judge Lamberth, as soon as he was convicted on seven counts, he remanded him straight into custody. There was no going home and, you know, spending 2 months before your sentencing hearing like so many other J6ers have done. And he wasn't even held in pretrial detention anyway. He was under house arrest. He was able to be at home for, you know, almost 3 years before his trial. And that's because he was not charged with any violence. And that's, you know, this is another big misconception that has nothing to do with January 6th, but I just want to get it out there. This thread that I wrote on X about John over the weekend, actually, I spent my birthday Saturday, I went to a great cigar bar in downtown Fort Worth, and I treated myself to, you know, the good stuff and expensive cigars, good adult beverages. And I sat there and created this, you know, this thread on X where I was going to answer questions about Sullivan because he's one of the singular most interesting characters of all of the January 6th characters. And I will tell you, finish up what I was saying, is that one of the things that it reveals itself in a long thread like that with hundreds of responses and hundreds of questions is how much misinformation and disinformation is still out there, not just about John Sullivan, but about January 6th in total. There are still people believe that hundreds of people are being held in prison without their due process, pre-trial, without trials, without being able to see their attorneys. And that's just not true. There's only like 15 or 16 people currently in pretrial detention that are J6ers. Now, there's more than that in prison because they've been through their trial, they've been convicted, they've been sentenced, but that's just not true that there's hundreds of people sitting in the gulag in, you know, solitary confinement in a dungeon somewhere without due process. It's just a lie. And it's a misconception that has been foisted on so many people on, you know, our side of the agenda by a bunch of conspiracy nuts and people that are disinformationalists. And that's, you know, that's really, Brianna, what the purpose of that thread was. And I said it from the outset was, as long as we can be respectful, I'll answer your questions. And most of them were. Most of them were respectful questions. And then when people disagreed with me, sometimes we had a respectful disagreement. But then when you get these people that claim, I know what I saw with my own eyes 3 years ago. No, actually, you don't. You saw what you saw on a small TV screen from one angle by one particular company or one particular person with an agenda or one particular media group, but you didn't see everything. Until you know everything and see everything from every angle, you don't really know what happened with that particular event on January 6th, not through a screen. Yeah. There's my rant.
Well, that's why I wanted you here, because listen, you know it better than anyone else does. You've known this case because you followed it extensively through. I mean, I understand that people don't believe the government. I would strongly advise people to ask good questions and to not just believe whatever you're told. I think that's really important. And they've done a lot to, you know, lose our trust. And so there's reason to be skeptical, but the conspiracy theories involved in here, and I hate that word because they've just, or that term, they've completely destroyed it. But they have created this lane of just people coming up with things that is extremely harmful. And I know this because, well, Stuart Rhodes was somebody, it took them a while to charge him for January 6th. And when I spoke to him, and he was after he was charged and he was sitting in a DC jail, he specifically was upset at those who accused him of being a Fed, was the term. And he was not a Fed. He was, in fact, somebody who they were trying to build a massive case against. And in order to do so, that they had to take some time to go around and to build a case. And it took them quite some time to charge him. But again, that doesn't mean he's a Fed. That just means you have to shut up and wait. And I mean, Stewart was interested in going after a lot of people and suing them for defamation because of it. And so we have to be really careful with our words here, because the word Fed is being thrown around a lot. And people need to understand something. A lot of these people are getting put into prison afterwards or jail afterwards. And those terms could really put someone in harm's way and get killed because they don't like informants in jail. And so I think we have to be a little bit more tuned into the facts and be a little bit more willing to listen to the facts rather than get aggressive. I mean, like you said, I put up that I don't support what happened to John Sullivan on Twitter because I don't agree with his politics, but I also don't believe nonviolent individuals should be sentenced at all to prison time that day. And people, you know, chewed off my ear for it. I said, we're not a cult. You're not supposed to always agree with me, and that's okay. Just right. Be respectful. And I think that's really the point I want to drive home here, especially that. But, you know, Steve, especially you, because you've dealt with all these crazies too, people following you around, they're not happy with your coverage, and they do show up. We mm-hmm. spoke about it last time when you were on the show. So I think that's an important part to drive home. But I want to talk about some of the questions that I received regarding John Sullivan. John Sullivan yes. obviously witnessed the shooting of Ashley Babbitt and filmed it. And that footage mm-hmm. was posted on social media, but it was also sold to CNN and MSNBC. I mean, sorry, NBC. And mm-hmm. so a lot of people were skeptical of him because, well, he was allegedly, according to some people, were speaking to a CNN employee. And then he ended up on CNN later that night. Now, I've worked in media for as long as I have, and so have you, Steve, but I've been there when we are purchasing footage, and it doesn't mean that they're an employee. I've often had to organize and orchestrate the purchase of footage, because, well, we that's the only way we could obtain it. So they want to sell it to you. They'll give you a price, and the network either pays it or they don't if they want to use it. So it doesn't mean that you're an employee, but he also did an interview that day. And again, that was CNN. And again, that doesn't mean he's an employee or somebody was working with CNN. That just means that they wanted to have him on. So yep. let's talk about that, because he made over $90,000 off the footage, I believe you said. Right. Where'd that money go?
Well, most of it was eventually seized by the government after he was arrested and charged with the seven crimes. I think by the time they seized the money, there was only about $75,000 or $78,000 left of the over $90,000 that he had received. He got $35,000 from CNN, $35,000 from NBC, and then, you know, smaller chunks from different news agencies around the world. And so, you know, like you said, that's not an unusual thing. There's a difference between working for someone, working with someone, and then licensing or contracting your work to them afterwards. And this was not a prearranged thing, as the theorists want to try and drive home and say that this was, he was working with CNN, that this was a planned thing, this was a planned operative, our operation, and that this was all, you know, set up in advance. And that's just not true. As a matter of fact, when I was contacted by USA 9, mm-hmm. in the afternoon of January 6th, I did two interviews with them that afternoon. By the time I was in my car and driving home the next morning on the 7th, I was receiving calls from Fox and from Storyful, all wanting to license my footage that I had taken that day. This is a normal thing that happens. He just happened to have captured probably, you know, arguably the most dramatic footage of the day. He captured the best. He wasn't the only person to catch her, you know, the shooting of Ashley Babbitt, but he captured the best video, or the clearest video, the most up close and the most comprehensive video of that event, because he captured the gun, he captured her in the window, he captured her going back down. And as a result of that, that was a very valuable piece of footage. As a matter of fact, one of the things that he said to Jade Sacker, the documentarian that he was there with that day, who was videoing him and his actions and activities that day, is he said, we're going to make $1 million off of this. You know, he actually thought they were going to get a lot more money than they did, because he has enough of an instinct as a self-promoting, you know, I hate the word grifter, that's been used too much, but, you know, he was trying to make a name for himself in this activist, anarchist, Antifa, BLM space anyway, and had been doing so for, you know, a year or more leading up to that, really making bones for himself during the 2020 Summer of Love riots. But that is something he had learned to do, was to make those connections with his videos. And he had made a connection with Jade Sacker, who was also quite connected. Her father is an entertainment lawyer and has worked on television and movies and Hollywood things. And of course, she had also, because she had done documentary work already and she had been contracted with some news organizations, she had contact. So I don't know who called CNN right away and who called NBC right away and got him on, CNN that night doing both of them doing an interview. I don't know how they made that $35,000 that quick from CNN and that $35,000 that quick from NBC. But the reality is that there were enough connections between his previous work and Jade Sacker to make that happen.
Yeah. And I think it's really important here. Jade, she was never charged. Is that correct?
No, she has not been charged.
Now, that's interesting. Why do you think that is?
And she, her dad's well-connected and probably powerful enough to keep that from happening. There's always those questions about that. The fact of the matter is she was, in fact, a legitimate documentarian before she ever met the Sullivan brothers. And that's what she was doing. This day in the life of John Sullivan on January 6th was a continuation of her work that she was doing, putting together a documentary between John Sullivan and his brother James Sullivan, the two brothers that basically were the white sheep, black sheep of the family, and you know, the good guy, bad guy, or the opposite guy, the hard left activist and the right wing Republican activist. And so she was doing a documentary about the brothers and their estrangement and their conflict between their two ideologies. And that was, and of course, it's a more interesting story than that because they're both black adopted children into a white Mormon family.
Yeah, and I think that's what caught people's attention too in all of this, because that was the interesting angle for sure. But there we have all these videos of him during BLM protests calling for violence. And this was somebody who did openly call for violence. And as we played in the open, would actively tell folks to go and go after Trump and was from that angle. Now, Steve, I have an issue with just – at this point, they've made a First Amendment absolutist out of me these days, because at this point, seeing that here's my point in this. Okay. Everyone's like, well, that's a violent threat that they just made. That's violent. Okay. But who is the person who's going to mediate what's violent and what's not? Because we see constantly with the left, they call us violent all the time on the right. And that's just the way it goes. So I don't want to be in a position where I have to be the one to sit there and call out what's violent, what's not, and what's covered by the First Amendment and what's not. Because again, it just depends on who is the one in charge of delegating all of that. So from what you witnessed during the trial, do you think Sullivan is a violent individual? And do you think 6 years in prison was rightfully earned?
He did and said a lot of things that immediately make you think of a violent individual. For instance, in this scene that you're showing again right here, he said at the end of that that video you showed, you know, we're going to go to D.C. We're going to pull Trump out of the White House. You know, we're not going to wait till November. And apparently, you know, Secret Service looked at that and went, that doesn't quite rise to the level of a threat. Then again, some group of people would say, oh, well, they'll let a left-wing BLM, Antifa guy say stuff like that, but they would never allow somebody on the right to say something like that. And, you know, we hear that all the time as well. But that's the kind of thing that we have to go up against when we're talking about these differing narratives. And look, let's just get this on the record. As you said earlier, I don't trust our government at all. I especially do not trust our FBI. I do not trust our DOJ. I am absolutely aware of and cognizant of selective prosecution and a very, very unbalanced system of justice, particularly as it's being applied to January Sixers. My own case is a great example of that. You know, there's over 60 journalists that came into restricted spaces that day. Many of them, most of them, before I ever even got there, they were there, you know, to see the signs that said closed area. I got there after all those signs had been removed. And so if they're going to prosecute me, who was completely well behaved that day, who completely did his job professionally that day, who did no violence that day, then they need to prosecute every other one of them. That's the type of selective prosecution that we've seen in all of these, you know, varying cases. But when we're talking about Sullivan, to get specifically to your question, is that, you know, he said a ton of shit that before he got there, while he was in D.C., on the day and then after that I disagree with, both politically and I object to the nature and the moral stance or implications of his speech. He also said insightful things that day. All right. He said insightful things that I don't think even rose to the level of Ray Epps, but Ray Epps got, you know, a slap on the wrist. And this kid got 6 years. He said stuff I don't like, but here's what he didn't do. He has no history of violence. He was arrested in Provo, Utah, in a previous protest that he helped organize, Provo, Utah, in which somebody was shot at and hit, but nobody was killed. He was arrested for that, but then once it was determined that he was not responsible for that act, he was released and the charges were dropped. He has been videoed demonstrating the black block attire. He's been videoed carrying the gun, an AR-15. He's actually very pro Second Amendment. Oddly enough, he's on some videos very, very pro Second Amendment in his rhetoric. But you know, this was my assessment after all the time that I've spent with him, his brother, his family in the trial, interviews, and watching. I have 2 hours of video produced by John that nobody has seen yet that I will hope to be able to release if I get permission from either he or the family. Once he's settled in wherever his new facility is in the Bureau of Prisons, I hope to be able to interview him and then during that process get permission from him to release either all of this video I have or some of that. And so when that happens, I'll be able to tell more of his story. But the reality is this. I believe that John was a wannabe leader in the BLM Antifa space. And the problem that he created for himself is he was too much of an activist. He was too loud. He was too boisterous. He was too self-promoting, especially for Antifa. He was, I think he was trying to make a name for himself in that space. He would actually, these have been taken down, but I have screenshots of some of this, where on some of his old YouTube videos, he actually called himself BLM Antifa leader. He actually, that was his self-labeled messaging under, you know, in the title on his YouTube videos. So he called himself that. And as a result of that, he alienated himself from the people in those organizations. And he was the first group, the Portland group, they disavowed him all the way back in November of 2020. The second group disavowed him like the week after January 6th. The point being is that they didn't like him. And believe it or not, they actually suspected him of being a quote unquote double agent for the right. Now, Interestingly, his dad agrees with that. And I'll be showing that when I reveal the interview. His dad actually, now look, parents, they love their children. And, you know, look, John and James are adopted. They're not even blood brothers. They're two black children adopted by a white Mormon family. Actually, they have four adoptive children. And, but they love their, you know, they love their sons. And they, you know, they're going to believe the best. You know, it's just like, you know, you can be a serial killer and your mom will go to her grave believing you never did it, you know, regardless of the evidence that's presented. And I'm certainly not accusing John of that. But for all of John's faults, all right, whatever they are, for all of his faults, his parents love him. And his dad and I disagree on that. I think that John was aggressively self-promoting, and that part of what he intended to do on January 6th was make a name for himself by leading a big, large group of protesters there, except for one thing, Brianna, he failed. It didn't happen. On his Discord channel, he announced where they were going to gather, where they were going to meet at 11 a.m. at the Washington Monument, and he never even went there because nobody followed him there.
So that's interesting. I think that kind of gives you a reason to speculate about, you know, his intentions for sure. I think there were some people questioning whether or not he had come with weapons. Did he have a knife on him? I know he had a gas mask. I'm aware of that. But did he have a knife?
Yes, when they were trying to get inside the main house chamber doors, and it's captured on video, people are trying, you know, they're looking for something to wedge the door, pry the door open, whatever. And he starts pressing his way through the crowd saying, "I've got a knife, I've got a knife, I've got a knife." In other words, he was volunteering the knife, not to stab anybody, but to help, you know, pry the door open or to unlock, pick the lock or whatever, whatever they thought they were going to do in that situation with guns, you know, drawn and aimed by the plainclothes officers on the other side of that door. They weren't coming through. And so the point being is that at one point he held aloft and you could see what looked like the handle of a knife. And then shown in his trial, the FBI zoomed in on that and they claim, it's disputed, but the FBI claims that from the grip itself or the handle of the knife, they could identify the actual make and model of it. And as a result of that, they determined that the blade was a quarter inch too long to be legal in D.C. So he ended up with two misdemeanor weapons charges, one for bringing one into the Capitol, one for having an illegal blade linked in D.C., and those were two part of his charges.
Wow. That's interesting. That's another part that I did not know. And so there's so much to kind of gauge and go through here. Steve, before we go, is there anything that we missed regarding his case specifically? Because you followed it all the way through. Anything that you would suggest our audience pay attention to with in regards to John Sullivan specifically?
Yeah. You know, the most interesting thing that I discovered about John is that when you watch him on these videos and you watch his behavior in the Capitol, it's not representative at all of his intelligence and his normal demeanor. You know, like for instance, he used a little bit of, I would, you know, characterize as street lingo or whatever, you know, in those speech he was making in the video you showed. He doesn't talk that way at all in person. He's as an individual, outside of his politics, outside of whatever we think we know about him, he's actually a very likable guy. And, you know, I can like people that I disagree with on any number of issues. But I still think that I have to, like you, I have to be consistent in how I feel about all of these January 6 cases. And that's this, is that far too many people have had far too more severe sentences levied against them for scary words rather than for their actual actions and deeds. And I feel the same way about John Sullivan, because everything else up to this point, whatever you think you saw, whatever you think you believe, whatever conspiracy theory you've listened to, whatever your own theory or your own opinion is, and however it differs from mine, it doesn't matter. The thing that we do not have evidence of is that he was involved with a conspiracy that day, or that he is a Fed. There is no evidence of that. Now, you can believe it if you want to. We all have a right to our opinion. But what we do know that day is that he committed no violence that day. And people who did commit violence that day, real violence against real law enforcement officers, they got much less severe sentence than he did. You know, 18 months, 2 years, four years, whatever. They didn't get 6 years. And I have, you know, been asked the question, and I have been willing to concede or conjecture that it could very well be that the government hit him harder than they did others who actually committed violence, because they were trying to use him as an example and make a point of their balanced and fairness across the board, across, you know, political beliefs and positions of why. Because obviously, Sullivan was not there as a Trump supporter that day. So some people believe that he was, you know, sacrificial lamb for that agenda. Now, he was sentenced by a Reagan appointee. So now you get to kind of, you know, you get to twist all of those details around in your mind. But the bottom line is that I don't believe that anybody that committed no violence that day, regardless of how much I disagreed with what they said and how they said it that day, deserves, you know, anything close to 6 years in prison.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Steve, I 100% agree with you. I strongly believe that he should not be sentenced to 6 years in prison. I think that is extremely, extremely outrageous. I know we don't fall anywhere on the same political scale at all. I don't agree with anything that he says. But again, that's I'm not the person to kind of decide what's free speech and what's violent speech. And yeah. I think once we start telling people to, oh, well, what he said was violent that day, and that's why he deserves 6 years in prison. Remember, folks, those tables will be turned on us one day if they want to say that something you said was violent. And then they'll rationalize it, and then they'll go after you. And it's happening right now throughout our country. So it's a slippery slope. You know, I was never a First Amendment absolutist at this point. I am now. And I think it's because January 6th has changed my mind completely on these issues. And so I would just, you know, recommend everyone be a little cautious before they jump to conclusions or get, you know, make really aggressive takes on somebody, because we don't know all the facts. We should wait till they all come out. And he was charged a couple of days after J6. So it's not like he was running around the streets and was, you know, was hanging out. He was charged. I get it. Like, he was charged but released. But I mean, he was charged with these crimes. And so, Steve, it's interesting to say
that. Yeah, there's so much different disinformation. We could parse them all out, and obviously we don't want to take the time to do that, and you probably don't have the time. But just think, if you're one of those people out there who thought he wore a Trump hat that day on January 6th inside the Capitol, that he was pretending to be a Trump supporter and he was wearing Trump paraphernalia and Trump clothing and a hat, you're wrong. Guess what? I thought that myself for over 2 years. You know why I thought that? It's because his own brother lied to me and told me that he was in BLM Square handing out boxes full of Trump hats that morning before they went over with his 200 followers to the Capitol. And neither one of those happened. We know that by the video evidence that was available to us in the trial of every moment of every step he took, basically from the time he left his hotel room that morning with Jade Sacker. It just did not happen. Plus, we have him on multiple cameras. He didn't wear any. He wore his black block attire and he wore a black hat. And that was, you know, or cap or whatever it was. But he never wore anything with Trump on it all day. So if you actually answer me and say, I know what I saw with my own eyes, and you're wrong about that, you just might be wrong about a lot of other things too.
Yeah. And I would tell everyone to definitely take a look at all the work that Steve's been doing, because Steve, you've been digging into a lot of these cases and going through the lies of January 6th, and you've done explosive reporting. So again, folks, he's over at The Blaze, and that's where the best source to go and find Steve's work. And obviously it's tpc4usa.com as well. If you'd like to follow him on all of the social media platforms, I highly recommend it. Steve, we appreciate all that you do and all the dirt digging you do and going through all of this, because there's a lot of misleading information out on the internet. So it's really important that we kind of sift through it and figure out the truth. So thank you for joining us today, Steve Baker. Now, many of you have been asking me about my skincare routine, and well, I've found the perfect solution for all of my skincare issues. I was having oily skin. I was having all the large pores. All these crazy things were going on with my skin, but I've seemed to manage it pretty well. So I'm going to give you my little secret. It's called Givaderm. I've been using them for months now, and well, it's been working wonders for my skin. I'm not having those outbreaks that I was once having before. And with the makeup that I'm always putting on my face, this works out perfectly for me. So let's head over to the Givaderm website. That's where you guys are going to see some of the best offers that they've ever had on their website. So right now, just because it's Mother's Day, they're running an incredible promotion that I think everyone needs to jump in on, right? It is the Facial Edition. Now, normally this product is very, very expensive, but right now it's actually on sale for $299, but it comes with five full-size products. Now, these five full-size products, I have to tell you guys, are game changer. They're natural. They won't do anything negative to your skin. I mean, I'm telling you, like, I used to get all these outbreaks from the products I was using. I'm not having any issues anymore. These five products are easy, so easy to use. I kid you not, it takes maybe a minute for each of the steps at most. I mean, the bamboo mist is a quick spray and that's it. So don't be intimidated by the five steps. It really is just a spa treatment that you're going to love. I know, I love it. I'm using it every single day. But not only are you going to get this for this great sale price right now, you're also, just for listening, going to get 10% off with the promo code Brianna. That's B-R-E-N-N-A. Brianna. Again, folks, it's Brianna, Brianna. And in addition to that, of course, for a very limited time, because, you know, we have Mother's Day coming up, they're going to throw in a free facial. Okay, so this is it's the face mask that I've been bragging about too. Let me grab that up for you guys. It is incredible. Literally, you leave it on your skin and then you take it off and your skin instantly feels so much tighter. I'm telling you, it is a game changer. So you've got to head over right now to giveaderm.com. Use promo code Brianna to get the additional 10% off. Brianna, folks. And then with the promo code MOM, M-O-M, you're going to get that free facial mask. I'm telling you, the facial mask is amazing. You have to try it. Everyone's trying it right now. I know our audience is loving it because I'm constantly getting feedback from you guys, because I always want to hear back about any of these products that I'm telling you about, what your feel for it is. Everyone's loving it. I'm seeing that everyone's also ordering refills, and that is incredible. So head over again, folks, to giveaderm.com right now. Use promo code Brianna for 10% off. Use promo code MOM on the facial edition to get that free face mask. And then make sure when you guys do so, you keep me in the know. My email address is on my Twitter page. Shoot me an email. If you love this product, tell me all about it. I want to hear from you. Again, folks, it's Giveaderm. You got to give it a shot. They're fluid in sarcasm. That's why we like them. Giveaderm is all natural products. I use it twice a day. I use it in the morning, and I also use it before I go to bed. And if you're looking to also improve your under eye a little bit, I've got to recommend this one for you too. It's also on Giveaderm's website right now. It is the eye cream. It's incredible. I use this under my eyes as well at nighttime. I love it. You don't put that much. Literally, a very, very small amount will do a lot. So that little amount got both of my eyes. And it's incredible. I definitely noticed the dark circles under my eyes have significantly gotten lighter, which is super important. And the creases as well, between this and the five-step system that I use, it's been incredible for my skin. So I highly recommend, if you're gonna get the five-step system, definitely add this one on. It's a great one. It's the eye cream, and it's another one that I highly recommend. You have to get this product. Click down the link below. Giveaderm is the product name, and the promo code for 10% off right now is Brianna. You may have missed it. Late Friday evening, we learned that the FDIC seized another bank. Now, you might recall there's been several banks seized by the FDIC because they're failing, obviously. This one was Republic First Bank Corp. It's a Philadelphia-based bank. And ultimately, it will now be sold to Fulton Bank, it looks like. But the FDIC is in trouble, and so are banks. And we know this because, well, they're saying it openly. And joining me now to discuss all of this is Dr. Kirk Elliott. Dr. Kirk Elliott, thank you for jumping on with us today. This is a very important subject, well, because you brought it to our attention that the banks were going to fail, and it looks like they are, in fact. We recalled, you know, I think it was just last year that three banks fell last year, and the FDIC is running low on cash. So tell us about this.
Well, you know, when Silicon Valley went under, it was Silicon Valley, Signature Bank, and Silvergate Bank. And then about a few weeks later, you also had Credit Suisse and First Republic. So it was in the first round, there was three, and then followed by a couple more. And then after those five banks failed, everyone was applauding the Fed, saying, you did a good job. There's no more bank failures. Wow, whatever you did, it was amazing. No, they didn't fix the gaping wound on the person's arm. They just put a Band-Aid over it. That Band-Aid was the temp funding program, which was just stimulus money to go to banks before they went into FDIC receivership. Well, that sunset, it's gone as of March 11th. So now this bank, which since Silicon Valley, I've been sounding the warning siren a lot that we're going to have round two of bank failures. This is the first one since then. And I think this is going to start the kind of contagion. And, you know, it's funny that not too long before this, that the IMF, like you saw in that video, was warning about more bank failures and bank runs, right? So why do banks fail? Because they've got more withdrawals than they have deposits and their investments are bad. That's why any bank would fail. So they're just simply undercapitalized and they ultimately run out. Well, in the past, you know, since Silicon Valley, not really a big deal in the sense that we didn't know when the banks were in trouble because they had that emergency funding. But now that they go to FDIC, it's a major problem because the FDIC, prior to this bank failing, to this bank in Philly, they only had 0.74, Brianna, of all assets, you know, to cover bank failures, 0.74% of all deposits. Now, that's bad because that's not even 1%. So this bank is going to take a big chunk of that. There's only a few regional banks now that all it's going to take to cause FDIC to completely run out of money, and which point they usher in central bank digital currency, in my opinion, to actually fix the problem. Well, that the second part of that video was Christine Lagarde, head of the European Central Bank, saying, in essence, we are going to criminalize and make it illegal to purchase anything with more than the equivalent of $1,000 in cash. So it's in euros, but the dollar equivalent is $1,000. So it's like, well, what if I wanted to spend cash? It's like, well, you can't. They don't want you to. They're going to criminalize it because they don't want paper money in parallel with digital currency, because you don't know who spent that money. You can't tax what you don't know. And they want to be able to track and monitor everybody. When you start looking at this with wisdom, you see what is actually happening right underneath our nose. And it's a power grab like nothing we've ever seen, to control people and what they spend their money on, the ability to know the source of all transactions, the use of all transactions, so they can tax you and control you. Because if they can control what you spend your money on, Brianna, they control you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's key. Also, Dr. Kirkelia, I also want to bring up the fact that, you know, earlier last week, we heard from a member of Congress who was very open about AI being used to go over people's banking information, and they don't even have a warrant to do so. And that was kind of the big red flag there, too. So everything that you just said is being backed by members of Congress. They're blowing the whistle on just that. So when it comes to all of these banking issues, what are you recommending that folks do to secure what they currently have? Because you just said they don't even have 1% right now to protect everyone's assets, really. All the money that they're pouring into these banks, they can't even promise you that it will be there in case the banks do fail.
Well, so I was just looking at a chart this weekend in a research piece, and three things are going up at the same time right now: the dollar, precious metals, and crypto. It's like, that doesn't ever happen. Those three never really move in parallel with each other, but they're moving for different reasons. So when you look at why gold and silver move and why crypto moves, it's the same fundamental forces. They want growth and they want privacy, the investors. So is crypto decentralized blockchain private? Yep. Which is why the central bank digital currencies that are coming in, which are centralized, it's the opposite of privacy. They're going to demonize all of the blockchain decentralized things like Bitcoin and everything else. So to me, it's like, if they're going to attack that really hard, not necessarily the best, but that's why it's going up. Gold and silver going up for the same reasons, privacy and growth. But yet that's not digital. It's a safer option. Well, why is the dollar going up? Well, so those two things are structural changes to the economy. People don't trust the government anymore. They want something that's real and private and growing. The dollar is not necessarily growing, but all the other currencies are shrinking worse, right? Which makes it arbitrarily look better, even though it's shrinking too. It's just shrinking at a lower rate than the other countries that are just falling apart, like Japan, the worst currency chart I've seen in the last 5 days. It's falling off a cliff, absolutely just being decimated. So that makes the dollar look better against the Japanese yen, but it's not doing good. So to me, the dollar strength or appearance of strength is seasonal. It's not strong. It's just because everything else is falling apart. But the move to metals and crypto is structural. That's more long lasting. And when you look at those two, I would do gold and silver rather than crypto, because crypto is still digital. It can still be part of a unified ledger. They can flip it off. All they have to do is cut off access of an IP address to a coin wallet or whatever they call it, and you're toast. You can't access it. Or they could limit your withdrawals because it's electronic. See, that's not as safe as having a tangible asset like gold and silver.
Yeah, I think that's what's so important here. I like to play it safe because we really don't know what's going to happen next. And they're always throwing us curveballs. So I like playing it safe. And folks, if you're at home right now wondering how you could get in on this too, just because it's so urgent that we have to do this now. You just heard Dr. Kirk Elliott say to you, they don't even have 1% right now, the FDIC, to protect your money right now in the bank. You've got to be able to come up with a plan right now before these banks, all of these banks do collapse. You know, you've been calling it for quite some time, Dr. Elliott. And I have to say, you've been great. You've been accurate on all of this. So for our audience at home, if you're looking to reach out to a member of Dr. Kirk Elliott's team, the best way to do so is by heading over to briannagold.com. That's B-R-E-A-N-N-A gold.com. Just a little contact form you're going to fill out. Then a member of his team is going to reach out to you, schedule the appointment, and then you could jump on a call with a member of his team and kind of go over all your financial plans. It could be small money that you're just kind of looking to shift over into precious metals, or it could be some other type of question that you guys have. But ultimately, it's good to just ask these questions and be prepared. And so just going to this website, filling out the form, that's probably the most challenging part of all of this. And then you could get on the call with them, kind of talk them through what you're looking to do and come up with a structured plan. We all need to do so. So again, folks, it's briannagold.com. That's briannagold.com. Fill out that form, schedule your appointment, and somebody will give you a buzz just to kind of go over everything and to come up with a plan right now. Because if your money is sitting in the bank, you're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And there's too much, there's too many unknown factors these days. So go with something a little bit more secure. I know I've done so myself. And so again, folks, it's briannagold.com. Dr. Kirk Elliott, we always appreciate having you on. Thank you so much for flagging this story for us.
It's my pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.
You guys, I've said it once before, so I'm going to say it again. And under the Biden regime, I've never been more worried about my financial future. I called my good friend Dr. Kirk Elliott because I wanted to come up with a plan put in place to make sure I was secure. And he came with a plan for me to invest in silver.
I'm rich.
I've got my silver. I'm feeling so much better about my future. I highly recommend you give him a call and just chat with his team. 720-605-3900. Now you could also head over to his website if you'd like to schedule an appointment. It's kirkelliottphd.com/Brianna. And if you enjoyed that segment, make sure you hit that like button. And if you want to see the news before it becomes the news, you have to subscribe to our channel. And well, if you have a liberal friend that you're looking to save, make sure you share this content with them.